Welcome back to Directly Current. I'm your host, Max Patton. This week, I have the pleasure of speaking with veteran EV journalist and serial freelancer John Volker. He was the editor-in-chief of an enthusiast website called Green Car Reports for over a decade. But now he freelances for websites like Wired, Car and Driver, and Inside EVs. In addition to reporting on all the new models and doing first drives and reviews, John goes really deep on subjects like how GM turned around its EV battery production woes, or how the Iona charging network turned from just a dream from several automakers into today's most rapidly expanding and exciting charging network. His writing is accessible, investigative, and full of rigor, and it's a great look at the EV industry. I'm going to take advantage of his time today to talk a little bit about how he sees this moment where some automakers and the public at large are bullish on hybrids and maybe hesitant on EVs in the US, while meanwhile abroad, Chinese and European EV platforms are moving along very rapidly. We'll talk about all of this and more. John Volker here on Directly Current. Please enjoy. John Volker, thanks so much for coming on to Directly Current.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure as always.
Yeah. So first, can you establish for people, we introduced you a bit at the top here, but you've been reporting on EVs for a while. You freelance at the moment. You wrote for Green Car Reports and did a lot of editing there. So can you just give us a little bit of an outline of your path in the EV industry? What got you into it from to where you are now?
Sure. I was always a car nerd, but it took until age 50 or so to get paid for being a car nerd, which was nicer. I had a bit of a sort of a life moment and decided if I was ever going to get paid to write about cars, the mid-2000s would be the right time. And there was almost no good journalism. There were no EVs then. There was no good journalism on hybrids. The general view of them among the auto media at that point was that they were technically interesting, but the only people who cared about them were smelly hippies and they didn't want to buy new cars. That's a direct quote. And I thought that was a niche. I am an engineer by training, although it's probably better for the world at large. I never got paid to engineer anything. And I picked that as my niche because it was clear electric cars were coming. And it turned out to be a good bet. I got hired to run Green Car Reports. I did that for 9 years, over 10,000 articles written or edited. And now I freelance for Car and Driver, Wired, Inside EVs, Charged EVs, and a variety of other places.
Yeah, you're a little bit like the Forrest Gump of the EV industry, and I mean that in the best way possible. I see.
No one has ever said that before, Matt, so I'm going to think about that.
I see your name pop up everywhere, but it speaks to the, as you said, lots of written copy you've done since the days of Green Car Reports. And
right
here, the industry's gone through interesting periods, obviously, since you started writing at the current moment we are now. You said back then it was largely hybrids. Now we're in a moment in the market where the public, and I say the audio industry too with journalism, is more interested in hybrids. And yet at the same time, electric vehicle journalism is its own thing. As you said, one of the places you write for, Inside EVs, they're also dedicated to that. Right now, you're a little bit, I always find it funny with your LinkedIn post. Plug-in hybrids are something that I think I find you often correcting the record on, with misconceptions, with what people think of them as compared to battery electric vehicles. So where do you think we are now technologically, given the market is very interested in those hybrids, and at the same time, electric vehicles are like better than they've ever been?
Sure. The overall term for all of this is electrified vehicles, which I react against because a lot of makers say, oh, look at these all electrified vehicles that we're making. People think they're making EVs, and they're not. They're making hybrids. But anything with one or more electric motors in the drivetrain is where I live. When I started Green Car Reports in 2009, the two primary search terms were hybrid and Prius. And when I left in 2018, the two primary search terms were Tesla and electric car. Hmm. So that speaks to the evolution among the cutting edge audience that read that site at that time. I think many of them probably read Inside EVs now. Green Car Reports, RIP, but such is the way of media. So it's important to remember back then in the late 2000s, hybrids were weird. Toyota spent 4 years buying ads that say, no, you don't have to plug it in. Yes, it's electric, but only sometimes, and you don't have to plug it in. Essentially, you don't have to change your life. But because the Prius, in order to maximize aerodynamic efficiency and maximize fuel economy, looked different from every other vehicle. Some Priuses looked better than others. They had an unfortunate generation that is now passed. But the Prius was essentially a statement car. There was no gasoline-only Prius. And I know people, usually on the older side, who still call them, oh yes, the Toyota Pilots, which I think was a South Park episode from almost 20 years ago. So hybrids had this image. What they have now become is simply a powertrain option. We went through a phase where diesels were going to be a fuel-efficient powertrain option. We know how that story ended. Hybrids are back now, but I have always believed, and I have an article in preparation, actually, that Toyota did the Prius almost as a science project, was slightly caught off guard when the second generation in 2004 and 2005 absolutely soared in the sales charts, which coincided with a sudden spike in U.S. gas prices. And so they got lucky there, and more people started to have Priuses and say, oh, yeah, it's a regular car, but I get 40 miles a gallon or 45 miles a gallon, just like any other compact vehicle, which at that point was getting maybe 22, 25 miles. So people got the Prius, but it still came with all of these overtones. Then Lexus introduced a hybrid and so on. Ford had an Escape hybrid, one of which I'm riding now, actually. And so they were still very much the exception. In the 2025 model year, almost everybody's got hybrids. A number of makers have a lot. Hyundai, Kia in particular, Toyota, obviously. Nissan doesn't have any. Mazda does now finally have plug-in hybrids, but Mazda, like Chrysler and Jeep, just says hybrid. They don't say plug-in, which gets us to the question you asked me 5 minutes ago, which was, why am I down on plug-in hybrids? And the answer is, I hope, like good engineers, I'm driven by data. And it is, to me, very indicative that no automaker, no major automaker, has released its data on how often people actually plug in their plug-in hybrids in North America. The exception is Volvo. But everybody, and they gave global figures. I've been trying to get North America broken out. But they at least were willing to talk about it. Toyota quite flatly says, oh yes, we have that data, but we're not going to release it because we worry it might be misinterpreted. And I think that tells the story right there. Plug-in hybrids are plugged in by a small, dedicated minority. And I keep hearing, yes, Chevy Volt. But the people who bought the Volt knew exactly what it was, right? They knew how it worked. They knew that you plugged in every morning and they could do 80% of their driving on electricity. They were the bleeding edge. They were the people who bought early Teslas, frankly. And so when you buy, let us say, a Hyundai Sonata hybrid, they had a plug-in for a while, right? People heard hybrid. They didn't hear the plug part. And they're like, oh, great. It's a hybrid. It's going to get much better gas mileage. And that was the end of it. That has been how plug-in hybrid Chrysler Pacifica minivans are sold. All the Jeep 4xEs are sold. You struggle to find anything at all about the plug in those showrooms, let alone a salesperson mentioning it. Because here's how the conversation goes. Oh, okay, so this one, it's a hybrid. So my neighbor has a Prius. They get great gas mileage. No, but it's a plug-in as well. You can drive it on electricity like an EV. Oh, like a Tesla. I have a coworker who has a Tesla. It's awesome. No, not like a Tesla. It's some of each. Oh, okay, how far does it go on electricity? Oh, 24 miles. Why would I want an EV who 24? Why? What are you talking about? No, let's just go with the normal. That's it. They're really hard to explain and sell. And I've tended to describe them as an auto engineer's answer to a bureaucrat's demand that no customer has ever walked into a showroom and asked for. And the bureaucrat's demand was, we want a car that will do the bulk of everyday miles on electricity. And this dates from sort of 2010 or 2005. How do we get more miles electrified without having to have this jugundo and extremely expensive battery? Because remember, in 2012, when the Model S came out, it started at 75 grand. That was two or three times the average vehicle back then. It was really expensive. The plug-in hybrid was seen by the bureaucrats and the engineers as a way to square the circle. It's just that they're incredibly difficult to explain how to use properly. And if you don't plug them in, it doesn't.
Yeah, which is telling. I've seen many rental Wrangler 4xEs. I don't think they ever get plugged in, but the blue badge, it looks great on them. Though I will say there's, like you said, there's that minority that does use and love them. I'm thinking of my uncle, Berkeley, California. He's got a Crosstrek plug-in hybrid. He fastidiously plugs it in every night. Many people don't do such things, I suspect, but the Volt, example you brought up, that had a community which still adores that car. But that transitions into my next question, right? General Motors took this strategy of basically inventing this modern parallel plug-in hybrid as we see it more commonly now, or the serial plug-in hybrid. And then now they have an all-electric strategy, and it's actually going well at the moment, though. I just remember 2 years ago, they were going through a bit of production hell getting these built in the U.S. You reported a lot on this, and they've turned it around since then. They have probably the most diverse lineup of any automaker at the moment for EVs. I think that's objective fact. So what happened? What were you reporting on when a bunch of people, I remember, were insisting that GM wasn't going to figure it out, that seems to have turned the corner for them now?
When I was finally able to get engineers to talk, and GM was set back 12 to 18 months. That was a big egg on corporate face moment, honestly. I think had they been able to get their Ultium EVs out 12 months earlier, they'd be much better established even than they are today. But I don't deal in counterfactuals. What actually happened was one of the advantages of Detroit and GM in particular is they're supposed to know how to build stuff. Building a car is an incredibly complex process. The supply chains are very large, totally global. You have to bring everything together in the right order. The seats come from one place and they have to arrive at the dock in the color order to match the car that'll be coming down the line 2 hours from then, etc. Really big logistical problems. GM is supposed to be the company that knew how to build stuff. It was not, as everyone thought, a software problem. They had software problems, but everybody had software problems, including Tesla. What actually stymied them for 18 months, in some cases, was that the battery modules for the Ultium vehicles are really large. You can think of them as a shoebox, but they're a shoebox for a basketball player and their ball. And they have the cells in there and wiring and sensors and so forth. GM built an extremely complicated module design, and the company that they hired, I had it rumored that it was a traditional tier one supplier that they bought stuff from for decades, but I was never able to confirm it. They flatly refused to talk about who it was. The supplier that they hired to make the automated machines to build those boxes could not do it, which is shocking to me just because, look, you guys make these insanely complex engines with four valves per cylinder and variable valve timing and all of this other insanely complicated electromechanical stuff, and you can't put a shoebox full of battery cells together for 18 months, really. Be that as it may, they finally sorted it out. I think they have multiple vendors now, but I'm not sure. And they started to get the cars out. GM now, to my shock, has 12 different EV models. I would have to struggle to name all of them. And they are seeing some very good volume with their Equinox EV, which is presently their least expensive one.
Yep.
Starts around 35, goes up to high 40s, maybe 50. It's a very nice vehicle. Yep. There is a short list of vehicles that our household would consider buying, and that one is on the list. I won't say where. But it is a good EV. It's not weird. It looks like a Chevy, but different. It behaves like a Chevy. It has the same interface as every other modern Jeep Parentala. And they have others as well. Moreover, they have the Bolt reboot coming out. I tended to refer to it as Boltium, but GM has decided that Ultium is no longer in its vocabulary. They have a tendency to make up brand names and then toss them. But it's essentially the old Bolt EUV, the longer of the two Bolts, with a brand new battery, lithium iron phosphate, brand new motor, brand new power electronics, brand new charging. But the body itself, pretty much the same. Don't know what the interior is going to be like. We will hear about that in Q4. It's actually a 2027 model. But that, along with the Nissan Leaf, the forthcoming Kia EV4, the Slate pickup truck, if it ever arrives, and probably a couple of entries yet to be determined, will make up this new category of lower priced EVs. And we're talking under $40,000, ideally starting around $30,000. Slate says $25,000, but you don't get 200 miles of range for that. And I think that will open up the EV market even without the incentives, because affordability is a massive problem and getting worse for autos in general. The average sales-weighted vehicle in the U.S. now transacts at almost $50,000, which is why we've got seven-year auto loans, the prospect of which terrifies me because you're underwater for most of it.
Yeah, and now I've seen 96 months is back on the table, some dealers.
Go on. Yeesh. So anyway, GM is hitting singles, and they have a new vehicle to come that I think is going to be significant. Meanwhile, and they are number two after Tesla. Tesla faces a number of real problems, in my view. Number one, their recent new product, or their only new product since 2020, the Cybertruck, has been a sales catastrophe. It has a bad public image. It's not a very good truck. And while it has some fascinating technology in it, they have sold about as many Cybertrucks as Hummer sold in 1 year when it had three different models, the H1, 2, and 3. Which is to say, it is probably as polarizing as Hummers were back in the day, and it's just not a vehicle that truck people want to buy. Mm-hmm. The rest of the Tesla lineup, which is largely the Model 3, launched in 2017, and the Model Y, launched in 2020, are now aging. And while Tesla stands will say with some justification, but the software keeps getting better, possibly true, but people want new sheet metal every so often. And GM has just rolled out 12 sets of new sheet metal, and we'll see what's coming down the road. Ford's in a quiet moment now, but they will have at the end of next year probably three different EVs within about a two-year period on their new low-cost architecture, because they too want to bring down the cost to make EVs more accessible and hence higher law.
Yeah. A note on what you said about Tesla, right? It was heavily been rumored for a while they were going to come out with something cheaper than a Model 3. And I believe at this point it's been confirmed that will exist, but it's going to be a Model Y that's more decontented. So not a revolutionary new product as it seems to be coming out.
And it's only when it happens. Model Y can take out of the Model Y, quite frankly.
To your credit, just so we prove, I think the Model Y is a fantastic car, but it is a very stripped down basic vehicle. To your point,
yeah,
there's not a lot of options you can remove from it.
And I would anticipate maybe a lithium iron phosphate battery, less range and less performance.
Yes, perhaps. And maybe they'll follow the direction of lots of their Chinese rivals at the moment where, you know, Tesla was state of the art in the US, is now competitive with, as you said, an aging lineup essentially of relevant vehicles that up until now have worked shockingly well, but seems like the competition is figuring out this turn on cheap EVs. It's not just GM. You mentioned, right, Slate might come out with that pickup truck. Ford's got the revolutionary new platform. I think you drove the Nissan Leaf EV recently for Wired. That's coming out imminently. What do you think it is about the current moment? Is it automakers reading like economic headwinds? Obviously, these things take years to develop, but what do you think it is about our moment right now that's leading to seemingly all of the cheap EVs coming out at once? And when I say at once, I'm giving myself like an 18 to 24 month
window. 2 year period, yeah. So a couple of things. Q3 EV sales as a percentage and probably in real numbers are going to be higher than they've ever been in the States before because the incentive ends on September 30th. Q4 sales will be lower. And I keep warning people, brace yourself for a bunch of uninformed headlines like EV sales crater, no market for EVs. Customers walk away from EVs. You know, you can write them forever. There is a base level of demand for EVs. It was probably slightly boosted by the incentives, but Lauren McDonald, the parent, has always maintained that the effect of the incentives are somewhat overblown, that the EV market will not be cut in half once the incentive goes away. Also, asterisk, all the state incentives in places like California and New York and various other states are still there. And I happen to live in a state that has a pretty generous incentive. It's not like the sky is falling. We will see a lot of headlines to that effect. But the reason that those low-cost EVs are coming is because down the road, people see that with volume, with economies of scale, with incremental improvements in battery technology, let's remember for 30 years, batteries have gotten about 8% cheaper a year. That's an average. And cheaper means either more energy for the same price or lower price for the same energy. And it's a combination of economies of scale, improvements in manufacturing, and improvements in chemistry. But it's an incremental process. If one more person asks me when we're going to see solid state EVs, because they're waiting to buy one, I'm going to throw something
in. Don't worry, that's not a must.
But as batteries continue to come down that curve, and that's an average, it's lumpy. There are mineral constraints. Obviously, China has a throttle on a lot, not all, but many battery minerals. But over time, those costs come down. It's not like gasoline cars are going to get cheaper because they are stupidly complex now to meet emissions rules. And yes, the current administration has said essentially there will be no more penalties of any kind for failing to meet emissions rules. Okay. They have also attempted to kill many EV incentives. Okay. They have also done all sorts of nonsense around the accepted science of climate change for political reasons. Fine. This administration will not be in place forever. And automakers are well aware that, A, the rest of the world is moving to EVs, including in some lower income countries that might surprise you, but certainly in Europe, let alone China, where more than half of the new vehicles sold are now EVs. The U.S. consumer will, in the end, still adopt them, regardless of all the trash talking you hear, and I hear a lot of it. And they have to make decisions for powertrains, for billion-dollar investments, for assembly facilities in what country that take years to implement, cost a lot of money, that those decisions outlast any given presidential administration. One of the challenges and frustrations for the auto industry, and I feel for them, is that above all else, they want regulatory certainty. They want to know 20 years ahead, what standards do we have to meet? Are the safety standards increasing? Great. Just tell us what they are and tell us that it's 3 to 5 years from now and not next month. Are the emissions reducing? Fine. We will meet those, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What they've had is a seesaw back and forth because the George Bush II administration slow-walked the EPA requirement that CO2 from the tailpipe be regulated. The Obama administration regulated it in two tranches. Trump 1 attempted to kill all that. Biden brought it back. Trump 2 is trying to kill all that. They're seesawed. They are essentially going to stick with the existing plan because, yes, we got Hemi's bit. That's very nice, Pat, to all my friends at Stellantis. That is not going to move the needle, and Stellantis has much bigger problems than whether or not it had the Hemi. Like, they don't really know how to make electric cars.
Unlike Ford and unlike GM.
But we will continue to see mortgages. Some of them will be cheaper. All of them will be better. They are not going to go away, but some of them have been and are being delayed to catch up with the market, because one of the drawbacks is still that EVs come with questions. And when I walk into a showroom, I've never owned an EV. Let's be kind and say it's a toss-up as to whether I'm going to get accurate, helpful, and appropriate information on how an EV works, whether my lifestyle is appropriate for one, which is to say, if I live in an apartment building and park on the street 6 blocks away, it's going to be harder than if I have my own private driveway, which is probably within 15 or 20 feet of electrical outlets somewhere. And so the sales stuff is a problem, but GM is quietly working through that, it appears. And it will happen, but it's going to happen not as quickly as the most optimistic estimates we saw 5 years.
Yeah, the timelines certainly seem to have shifted, though. As you said, right, you're dealing with laws of economics, laws of regulatory certainty that were baked in over a decade ago or decades ago, if you consider the history of the Clean Air Act. And it's complicated future right now with how states are implementing it, specifically, right, California's whole authority over that. Looking towards the global perspective here, right, there's this rapid iteration of the Chinese auto industry to the extent that they now have an oversupply of extremely competitive, extremely low-cost EVs that don't just make the Stellantis Dodge Charger look bad, they make the state-of-the-art in our market look bad. Maybe the Lucid Gravity or some of the very high-end premium options could meaningfully compete, but lots of these Chinese vehicles, seemingly from a technology perspective, the charging, the efficiency, the things that would manifest and what most people care about in their car, these vehicles are really good. Do you think that's going to impact? Obviously, I'm not asking you to predict the future, but do you think there will be some kind of partnerships that have to form, technology sharing agreements? Or do you think that our auto industry has a lot of reason to be really scared about its future at all in terms of Ford, GM, these American companies? What do you think is on their horizons as they're laying out these next EV platforms, while it seems like China may actually be already ahead of them, at least on paper?
I think the overarching question from the North American auto industry, it's been given a breather against the Chinese industry with a whole variety of tariffs. Those came with a lot of other costs, making cars more expensive because they had situated their production base under the terms of NAFTA and then its follow-on, only to have the rules changed under them in 4 months. And you cannot relocate an assembly plant in 4 months. But they have been given some breathing room where they will not have to compete head-to-head with Chinese vehicles. Will they use it? Will they learn the lessons? And will they change what they do enough? And I'm not going to predict how that question will come out. The smart minds in Detroit very clearly understand what that's about. No less a person than Jim Farley, the CEO of Ford, said he spent several months driving a Xiaomi as his daily, and he was astounded how good it was and scared at what it meant for his company. And that led to Ford's whole skunkworks, low-cost Model T moment, as they keep saying, reinvention of their future EVs. GM is approaching it differently with volume and reducing costs on batteries. I've had a few articles talking with Kurt Kelty, the Tesla battery czar, who was persuaded out of his after Tesla life to come to GM and think about their EV battery strategy. And honestly, the fact that GM hired Kurt and Kurt went to GM gives me a certain amount of optimism that they will move at a greater speed and make some of the right decisions. You talked about me being Forrest Gump. I actually went back and checked. Apparently, I first interviewed Kurt Kelty in 2008. That one, you could call Tesla, get an employee, and have lunch with them, but can't do that anymore. Anyway.
The communications department's ago, or absence of a communications department. But
I'm told they have one now, and I'm also told that they no longer auto-respond to queries by media with a poop emoji. But quite frankly, I haven't tried it. So, will Detroit, and for that matter, everybody else, and I put VW into that category as well, I think, least worried about the Koreans, who are incredibly aggressive, and probably in the long run, Toyota. I think Toyota very slowly is turning the aircraft carrier, and if they really turn their attention to making truly competitive EVs, they know how to be made cars at a greater profit than any other mass market maker in the world and have for decades. So if Toyota has finally gotten religion on EVs as opposed to being arm-twisted into it, I think they'll be fine in the long run. The problem children are probably Stellantis, Nissan, and the smaller makers. Subaru and Mazda and Mitsubishi are all Mitsubishi's an arm of Nissan now. Mazda and Subaru, to a greater or lesser extent, are part of the Toyota Keiretsu. But the Europeans, and in the U.S., aside from the high end, it's really only Volkswagen. The Europeans are struggling. And they see Chinese EVs there, and they know how good they are. I would just point out, though, I've also seen a lot of misinformed stuff about this amazing $15,000 Chinese EV will destroy the American auto industry. I started to think in YouTube headlines. I apologize.
I think we all have, unfortunately.
God. Exclamation point. You'll never guess what happens next. And that $15,000 EV, it being sold for that price in China, probably at a $5,000 loss.
Yeah.
Subsidized by the various state and national owners and other governments who all have shares in these different makers in order to ensure their maker survives the vicious dogfight that's happening now and somebody else's maker goes away.
Yeah.
So that might be a $20,000 car in China. Then you have to add probably $5,000 more for federalization costs. The U.S. has different airbags. It has different safety requirements that are much stiffer than other people's in some ways. There's a load of special equipment you have to build into the car for the U.S., et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Now, I have no doubt that the Chinese can and will do this, but a $15,000 car sticker price in China is not going to sell for $15,000 here if you take away all the tariffs.
Yeah, I like what RJ Scaringe, the Rivian CEO, said on the Inside EVs podcast recently. It's not the cost of the Chinese EVs that the American should be alarmed by. It's the product and the engineering, right? Because the cost, when everything's said and done, tariffs, factories here, regulations, compliance, labor, they're going to be similar in our market as they would be otherwise. But it's the product and the engineering where they're differentiating. And that probably is the thing that should be sending alarm bells to everyone, including Tesla and Rivian, who think they're better than everyone else. And maybe they are, but it's scary stuff for everybody else, of course.
The last comment I think I made about Chinese cars, one of the reasons, there are several, that non-Chinese makers are rapidly being shown the door and kicked out of the Chinese market, is that they were not able to update their software fast enough to keep up with Chinese consumer desires. I'm not convinced that a lot of the Chinese consumer-facing software is going to translate to this market. And one story I'll give you, Lincoln in particular has been touting this auto as a third space. You have your work, you have your home, but you can also go to your car and just chill out. They have relaxation modes with scents and music and massage and seat warming and cooling and special lighting. It's lovely. I've done it a couple times. It is now in China, where you have multi-generational families in many cases living in what Americans would consider to be very small residences or apartments in high-rise buildings. A third space does in fact let people get away by themselves or with their beloved. In the U.S., we just go to another room in that house. We don't need that. And that's not the case for everybody, but it is often the case for for the households who can afford to buy a new car.
Yeah.
So in the Lincoln that is built in China, the Nautilus, it has a very interesting full width screen right at the base of the windscreen, which is not nearly as difficult as I thought it would be because it's nice big characters for old people. But they also have this relaxation mode. And we demonstrated it. They talk about it extensively. And at the drinks afterwards, one Lincoln person, who I will not name, came up to a group of journalists and said, "Did you think anyone cares about that?" And to me, that was indicative of a feature developed for another market where it's not clear that Americans were really wanting. Lincoln is advertising it. I would love to know the data on how many people even use it, because my experience is that in most cases, when you are waiting for a child at a sports game or waiting for something in your car, you take out your phone and you spend 15 minutes staring at your phone.
Yeah.
Do you want to relax? Yeah, ideally, maybe. But do you want to tell your car to do all this stuff to give you an environment in which to relax? I don't. And we'll see. I think the point about Chinese software is the speed of upgradability, the ability to offer options, including for pay options, which the Chinese have really taken to, which is a whole other discussion, but not for this podcast. And the fact that they're really creating what we have come to call software-defined vehicles, which is where you have a software architecture on top of which you build a vehicle that can be frequently updated.
Yeah, and that's where our best hope would be Rivian, Tesla, hopefully Ford, and everyone else who could catch up with their new platforms. Thank you so much for your time. I know we went over, John, but before you leave, you are a petrol head in every way. So you do have, I believe, a YouTube channel called Tempting Fate Tours, where you and your friends drive old British cars around the country. Is that right?
Not only old British cars, but often old British cars.
Yeah.
Generally old, frequently unreliable. For the 9 members of your audience who care about Isuzu cars, our latest video is actually about taking 10 old Isuzus and driving them thousands of miles. But yeah, check out Tempting Fate Tours on YouTube, subscribe, etc. And thank you for letting me make the plug.
Absolutely. Mike, who's listening, I'm sure if he wasn't such a Detroit head, he would subscribe right away, but he's a little bit biased. Thanks so much for your time, John.
All right, take care. Bye.
That was John Volker, an engineer by training, but a great journalist today, huge asset to the EV community, and I have to thank him again for his time. Thank you for listening, by the way. Directly Current releases every 2 weeks, and we're in YouTube or your podcast app of choice, so subscribe in whichever feed you want to follow. You can also check out the work we do at EVs for All America with a link in the description for the podcast or the show notes, wherever you're getting it. I'm Max Patton, your host, and I'll see you again in 2 weeks with our next episode.